thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson, and I'm doing this episode from Seoul, South Korea, so you're going to have to excuse all the crazy ambient noise and traffic and all that shit. It just comes with the territory. And I'm here. This episode is, it's sort of a raw and cut episode. We're focused on one specific issue happening in the real world, but it's not going to be 10 minutes. It's not going to be a normal formatted show. It's really a travelogue. So I'm on the ground here doing research about extended deterrence and U.S. the credibility of U.S. alliances. And a lot of crazy shit has come out of my meetings and interviews. I'm going to try to find a way to share some of that at some point. I've also had to do a lot of like singing for my supper to pay for this trip. And so I've been given presentations and talks left and right. What you're listening to today is a talk that I gave about North Korean arms control based on some underlying research I published recently. It was a good talk. I'm posting it here because I think a lot of you will find it useful. Even though I'm not dropping a ton of F-bombs, I do speak in my normal candid way. It's just packaged as a lecture to an audience, like a crowd. And there was like TV cameras and all that shit. So, you know, I'm being more formal, but I'm being as candid as I always am. So anyways, when I'm talking, you're going to hear me referencing things that you can't see because I had, of course, you know, PowerPoint slides with me. And so I think you'll be able to just more or less figure out based on what I'm saying, everything. It sounds like a good talk to me. It's why I'm posting it. But in the very beginning, the first slide says, quote, it's saying the denuclearization era is over. And at the highest level, that is what I am arguing. And so I believe that if you have trouble accepting that statement, then you're going to have trouble accepting the very premise of all of my policy recommendations and my talk and my rationale, et cetera, et cetera. If you can accept that statement, the denuclearization era is over, then everything I have to say is going to go down easy. So that's what's being referenced because I don't say those exact words, the denuclearization era is over. I don't say the exact words in the talk. It's up on the screen, but I keep referencing it. So that's what that is. I hope you enjoy the show / talk, and then we're going to get, you know, normal show back to you real soon. Peace. So thanks everybody for coming. Thank you for Professor Moon for hosting this event and the East Asia Foundation. The talk I'm giving today is the underlying content is based on research I published recently in a report for the Center for a New American Security. So if this isn't clear enough, I believe this statement reflects reality. If you can accept this change in narrative, everything I'm about to say today makes a lot of sense. If you resist this change in narrative, if you think this is wrong, if you reject it, you're probably going to contest at least part of what I'm going to say today. So this, what you think about this statement is a good litmus test for what you will think about everything I'm about to say. Okay, so this is the argument in brief. There's four related propositions. The overarching statement in its most generic form is that arms control as an approach to North Korea is logically in tension with the goal of denuclearization, the elimination of North Korea's nuclear and missile capability. Related to that large sort of broad meta point is my contention that denuclearization, the rhetoric of denuclearization, actually makes diplomacy significantly harder. Adherence to the goal of denuclearization has become a form of what Victor Cha would call and promote hawk engagement with North Korea, which is a form of kind of like bad faith diplomacy. And I'm going to talk about this a little bit. Denuclearization is not cost-free. We all tend to think of it as something that's desirable, like a rainbow or world peace or something, and that's fine, but it's neither cost nor risk-free. This is a bit controversial to say. Actually, everything I'm saying is controversial, to be honest. I accept that, okay? I live in New Zealand, so I'm very far away from the artillery shells of Washington. I'm out of range. So I'd say 90% of people, experts, technocrats, former policy officials, scholars, who make proposals about how specifically we should negotiate with North Korea, what is the proportional bargaining strategy, what transaction do we need to do to convince North Korea to give up nuclear weapons? I think this is mostly well-intentioned. I think it's completely destined to fail, and the fact of North Korea's nuclear weapons now serve as proof of that. My goal in this report was to make what I think is like the first ever negotiating proposal on North Korean nuclear weapons that takes seriously the need to make the negotiations credible, which is to say they take into account the requirements of trust building for the sake of security. And so my claim is that we can manage the situation and the risks of nuclear instability in Korea better if we're actually more realistic. And our starting point is not what is our goal, but what is the situation and what is achievable, and then working within those constraints. And that requires bitter medicine for the United States in particular. And this is yet another controversial point, which is that I believe there is no package or bargain that we can arrange with North Korea. There is no outcome that we can agree to with North Korea that leads to an elimination of its nuclear weapons. The best we can achieve is a sort of stable accounting and control and maybe reduction in North Korea's nuclear capability. And to get that relatively modest goal, we're going to have to make significant, other people would call them concessions. I would see it largely as just unilateral actions the United States needs to take. So the United States has the burden of responsibility because it is the great power, because its existence is not at risk in this bargaining process. We know, I'll talk about this more, but we know a lot about the problems of trust building and credibility between strong states and weak states. And the burden for making negotiations credible falls on the great power. And the great power in this case for 30 years has only cared about North Korean credibility, not our own credibility. Okay, so denuclearization, I think a lot of people think of it as at least cost-free. It's necessary. It's one of these goals that would serve as a public good in general. And why not pursue denuclearization? It is the conventional wisdom. It is, to a large extent, the consensus in the alliance and in Washington especially. But when we look at what North Korea tells us over time, Choi Soon-hee, KCNA, the foreign ministry in North Korea, Kim Jong-un himself, repeatedly, this is just a sampling of some of the things North Korea has said since 2016, their nuclear weapons are essential to their survival. They rectify an imbalance of power with the United States. We know this. Everybody knows this. So why would they abandon that insurance, right? And in that context, denuclearization is the unilateral disarmament of North Korea. Why would North Korea accept that goal? That's a problem. That means that our well-intentioned aim of denuclearization is itself a threat to North Korea. North Korea rejects that goal. We see this in North Korea's word and deed, but generally speaking, we ignore it because we like our rainbow goal, our utopian goal. We feel better about ourselves, like we have moral superiority if we pretend that we can all just pursue North Korean denuclearization and Steve Biegun might save us. No. So this should be very familiar to everybody. Everybody knows why we want North Korean denuclearization, right? North Korean nukes hold U.S. allies at risk. Now it holds U.S. territory at risk of strike. Because North Korea can hold U.S. territory at risk of strike, there is the possibility of decoupling the United States from the protection of allies. There's a concern about the global nuclear nonproliferation regime, right? The global nuclear taboo. And there's a concern also about, frankly, if North Korea has nuclear weapons as an actor sort of outside of the norm of the international system, that they will traffic proliferating nuclear weapons to other countries. It's not so crazy. We saw them try it in Syria in the early 2000s. So all of these reasons are sensible reasons for wanting to disarm North Korea. But it's also sensible to want world peace. It's also sensible to want global zero and the elimination of nuclear weapons. That's not what matters. What matters is what's your theory for how you are going to get rid of these nuclear weapons or achieve this quixotic goal through policy. And when you take a quixotic goal and you make it the concrete objective of policy, you end up distorting your policy in pursuit of something that cannot be achieved. We've clearly failed so far to denuclearize North Korea. This is not a big surprise. And this just is a statement of why we would want to get rid of North Korean nukes. And I don't disagree with this. So I was in the Obama administration. I was implementing, making North Korea policy. I was part of the system that was reifying and reinforcing all these things. And we do the performative, denuclearization, six-party talks. Let's go back to six-party talks, blah, blah, blah. The end result was a nuclear-capable ICBM. So if what matters is how you go about your goal, what you do for policy, we should consider how North Korea responded to that. When we look at all the missile tests that North Korea conducted, basically in its history, you start to see clustering in three specific areas of the timeline. Those three areas of the timeline just so happen, actually not just so happen, those three areas of the timeline are the periods where the United States pursued the most significant pressure on North Korea. These were periods of U.S. coercion, of mutual enmity between the U.S. and North Korea. And the more the United States ratcheted pressure, the more North Korea tested missiles. And testing missiles is the most direct way to improve its nuclear and missile capability. So the approach that the United States has taken for the past 30 years has helped get us to this very dismal, bleak point that we've reached now. I'm going to come back to why this matters, if it's not obvious. And so when we say that we want to maintain the goal of denuclearization, even though 100% of policy officials that you talk to will acknowledge that, we don't expect North Korea to give up nuclear weapons, but we're going to keep saying that's the goal. At the top of our information memos to our negotiators and our senior leaders, when we have our negotiations, when we formulate policy internally, that top line goal of the objective of the administration, in every administration, it's still gonna say the goal is denuclearization. And then those policymakers in every presidency have to come up with policy measures that plausibly move them toward the goal of denuclearization. And that's why it matters so much that we established up front that North Korea is not going to give up nukes, that the goal is quixotic, it is unrealizable, it is unrealistic. Because it means the United States has to keep taking greater risk to achieve what is an increasingly ambitious end state goal. But the result is this. The result is more missile testing. The result is a greater capability. So how long can we do the same thing and expect a different result? My God. So this is, and I spend more time in the report talking about this, but this is precisely why holding to the goal of denuclearization is neither cost nor risk free. It is the goal of denuclearization that justified the maximum pressure campaign in 2017. And of course, maximum pressure was the proximate cause of the crisis,
right, from the U.S. perspective, the worst since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And without the judgment that Kim Jong-un could not be trusted with nuclear weapons, the United States would not have been able to pursue this path to bloody nose, path to conflict, to prepare for war, to make these bombastic threats of war. All of that was only justifiable within a frame of reference where we had to stop Kim Jong-un from getting nuclear weapons. That's the only way you can rationalize all of that crisis-inducing activity. So denuclearization itself, and I wrote a book about this in 2018 called On the Brink, available in bookstores now. And that book documents in pretty fine-grained detail how denuclearization itself fueled this crisis. It wasn't the only factor, right? But if you were able to change this goal to something more modest, all that maximum pressure, fire and fury, all that stuff would have been unjustifiable. And so the risk of crisis instability in Korea is elevated because of enhanced US risk-taking when the paradigm is denuclearization, and because of what I showed you with the missile testing trajectory, right? North Korea responds to pressure with pressure. This is empirically demonstrated over time. It's almost impossible to argue against it, although maybe somebody will. North Korea responds to pressure with pressure. And more pressure is the only path to denuclearization in Washington's mind. This is bigger than Trump. And then this notion of poison pill for diplomacy or hawk engagement, right? The idea that you go through the theater of diplomacy, the actions of diplomacy, you use the rhetoric of like being pro-engagement, but you structure diplomacy in such a way that the odds of achieving a positive outcome are close to zero, right? Most, if there are any diplomats in the room, you'll probably have a problem with me saying this, but most diplomatic negotiations are predestined to succeed or fail before they even start based on the structural constraints of the situation. It's the job of the diplomats to figure out, given all of these constraints that we have and that the other side has, is there a win set? Is there a mutually acceptable outcome given all these constraints, right? It's not that you're trying to create magical outcomes on your own, untethered to reality. And so the job for diplomacy becomes harder and harder depending on what those background constraints are. And so denuclearization, as much as it seems like a positive thing, it is again the unilateral disarmament of Kim Jong-un. If you want to achieve only, like, when you talk to most Washington policymakers, they want to just go after a small deal, some sort of mutually acceptable bargain. It's going to be well short of denuclearization, but they also want to hold on to the rhetoric and goal of denuclearization. That's the best case scenario that we could hope for. That's the best case scenario that Washington hopes for. And it's sort of always been that way. Even in that best case scenario where you achieve some small progressive deal with North Korea, you're telling Kim Jong-un that is a baby step toward his unilateral disarmament. That makes the whole thing disingenuous from North Korea's perspective. Why? You're creating incentives for Kim Jong-un to renege or to come off of the commitment or to not fulfill any bargain that is reached at the negotiating table. Why would Kim Jong-un agree to take small steps that lead to his eventual disarmament? If we tell him and if we tell the world that these small steps are supposed to lead to him giving up nuclear weapons, what incentive does he have to do that? Again, that's why that initial judgment about whether North Korea could foreseeably give up nuclear weapons matters so much. And I think any reasonable person thinks the answer is like, no, they're not going to do that. And my contention partly is that the whole nuclear crisis itself and the risk of war in 2017, that emerged from the fact of denuclearization as a goal itself. So if not denuclearization, why not arms control, right? I've been promoting some version of an arms control argument since I left government in 2014. And there have been three major arguments against pursuing arms control with North Korea. The first is the moral hazard problem or more specifically, that engaging North Korea in arms control, the way that the U.S. has engaged China and the Soviet Union in arms control, elevates North Korea's international status. So it's the argument against granting North Korea status, because then it's kind of like rewarding North Korea for bad behavior, right? But then we saw with, that is one of the perverse silver linings of the summits, right? The summits were with Trump and Kim Jong-un were total failures, but Trump said coming out of the first summit that he was asked about this status question, like, you're normalizing Kim Jong-un internationally. Like, you're laundering his reputation. You're making him a world leader like any other, basically. And he said, yeah, good. I hope I gave him credibility. I want to give him credibility. It's a quote in my book. There is no greater symbolic status granting that the United States could give to North Korea than a presidential summit, than multiple presidential summits. So this argument, there was some merit to it maybe before 2017, but ever since the summits, if you supported the summits, you can't make this argument. That's insane, right? Having an arms control negotiation with North Korea is not going to grant North Korea more status than summits with the US president. So the second argument against arms control is that North Korea cannot be trusted to implement its agreements. And actually, the US and North Korea have a very poor track record of implementing agreements that we've reached, right? There's a lot of partisan debate about who's at fault there. I think we're both at fault, frankly. But it's understandable that you would be worried about North Korea not living up to its commitments. It will not fulfill whatever agreement it reaches under an arms control regime. Maybe so, but this is not an argument against arms control. This is an argument against negotiating with North Korea at all. If North Korea cannot be trusted to implement an arms control agreement, it also cannot be trusted to fulfill a denuclearization agreement or any other kind of agreement, right? So this is not an argument against arms control. It's an argument against basically dealing with North Korea, just period. And then third, even if arms control is successful, and even if the U.S. government ends up doing everything I'm recommending here, North Korea will still be able to hold U.S. allies at risk, U.S. territory at risk, possibly, of attack. And this is true, but the threat that North Korea can pose to allies in an arms control regime has to be compared to the threat it would pose right now under a status quo trajectory. What kind of threat will North Korea pose if you have no agreement with them, if they're able to continue developing their nuclear and missile capability unrestrained as they effectively have been able to do for the past X number of years, right? Since 2011, 2012 at least. And so it is true that under an arms control regime, North Korea will be able to still attack U.S. allies. But North Korea's ability to credibly threaten U.S. allies will be marginally less than it is now, marginally less than the status quo trajectory based on right now. And we need to remind ourselves, because we never do, that there's no such thing as absolute security. The pursuit of absolute security is how you end up doing stupid shit, like invading Iraq, right? It's the pursuit of absolute security that makes you do dumb stuff. That's what justifies bloody noses, for example. And so if there can be no absolute security, then an arms control regime makes a lot more sense. And so I scream it from the mountaintop. My argument for so long now is that, look, North Korea is a nuclear state. We can have a debate about like granting them the status of a nuclear state. We can have a debate about how this relates to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. But this needs, for the purpose of policy planning by South Korea and the US, this needs to be the goal. Not denuclearization, but the thing that matters most. This is the main purpose that the alliance itself should serve now. We've got to reduce the risk of nuclear war. What goal could be more important than that? And this was not even a consideration in U.S. policy in 2017. And that's how we big fat ended up in a crisis. When this is everything that you aim your policies toward, the content of your policies look very different from how they've looked for the past, whatever, 30 years, 20 years. And so this is a snapshot of the blueprint that I propose in the report for how to engage in an arms control regime, a credible arms control regime with North Korea, one that stands a real chance of North Korea actually adhering to, fulfilling on its side of the bargain. And there are a number of initiatives here. For the sake of time, I can't walk through each one. I want to hit a couple highlights, and I want to point out one thing that is crucial, which is that for 30 years, when U.S. policymakers, South Korean policymakers too, mostly U.S. policymakers, when they engage in diplomacy with North Korea, they skip the column on the left, and they jump straight to phase one or phase two. And that completely ignores what it takes to establish credible commitments. That completely undermines the ability for diplomats to achieve and implement something real with North Korea, given our mutual adversarial status. And so, keeping the credibility of negotiations in mind, there is a lot that needs to happen, that the U.S. needs to do. It's the Americans' burden in order to show that this is not just transactional, because transactionalism will never, never, never achieve denuclearization. It will never stabilize the situation long term. If it's transactionalism between enemies, you know, Koreans are damn good negotiators, right? And North Korea has proved that they're damn good negotiators. So we need to broaden how we do this so that it's not transactional. It's about transforming the larger context within which transactions occur. And so these unilateral actions that I propose, if you do just one of them or two of them or something, it is not going to change the situation. It's not going to change the context within which negotiations happen. And that's the problem with this little tit-for-tat stuff like we're doing now. So like Secretary of Defense Mark Esper comes to Korea, says we're going to suspend military exercises. Oh, woo-hoo, in the name of diplomacy. That's so thoughtless in the sense that it's untethered to any like strategy. Suspending exercises could achieve something in a wildly different context. But when you make one minor move on the board by itself in isolation, the execution of one small tactic is not going to achieve some big strategic goal. That's idiocy. That's insanity. So there are scenarios where you could do stuff like suspending military exercises, but it has to be structured strategically, in sequence, in the context of other moves that collectively signal something, that credibly signal something. If it's just an isolated move, we do this one little thing. We move our pawn on the board, one move. What is that going to change? Why would that's going to get North Korea's nuclear weapons out of North Korea. Get out of here. So what I'm proposing is that over a period of time, presumably after Trump leaves, but it could start now, we need to stop emphasizing the rhetoric of denuclearization. It would be helpful if the bureaucracy and the president, not one or the other, we need both in this era, would say that, like, look, denuclearization is no longer a serious goal of U.S. policy. It's something we very much want. It's a vision. It's a long-term ambition. We're not orienting our policy toward that end. We're orienting our policy towards nuclear stability in Korea. Why? Because we want to reduce the risk of nuclear war. And North Korea already has nukes, and we're not blind. We see that. In the early Cold War period, it was thought that the U.S. and the Soviet Union could not peacefully coexist, right? And that notion animated a lot of aggressive Soviet policies. And it was only after Nikita Khrushchev decided in the early, mid-1950s that the Soviets could coexist with U.S.-led capitalism, It was only at that point that foreign policy initiatives within the Soviet Union had justifications for restraint. And I think something along those lines could work here, but in the opposite way. If we can, instead of H.R. McMaster, the old national security advisor under Trump, instead of him saying, you know what, we can't live with a nuclear North Korea, we can't trust Kim Jong-un with nuclear weapons. If we said instead, look, you know, as long as you're not actively threatening our allies, there is very clearly a future where we can peacefully coexist with North Korea. And we establish that loudly and proudly, because we've already acknowledged some version of that, but just making it explicit, right? Changing the rhetoric and the narrative around the negotiations makes a big difference. And in that vein, so that's like cheap talk stuff, right? It's symbolic. And so where's the beef, as they say? Like, what is the more costly stuff that the US might need to do to change the context? We do need to have broad spectrum engagement with North Korea, which is to say, when we engage in track 1 and track 1.5 dialogues with North Korea, it can't just be narrowly in the foreign ministry channel. Again, this is controversial. The foreign ministry is only one interest group or bureaucratic actor in North Korea. Within their own national security system, there are all these other stakeholders. And Kim Jong-un's the man on top, right? But he doesn't decide everything, and he certainly doesn't implement everything. There are lots of functionaries with lots of different provable preferences for different policies. So what the United States has done with China for a while now is they've had track 1.5 negotiations, not negotiations, dialogues, that's been institutionalized. It's called a strategic stability dialogue. And it helps create nuclear stability in the China-US relationship. And what it does is it takes national security experts from China, from the US, current officials, former officials, it's track 1.5, and they compare understandings of deterrence, military doctrine, nuclear doctrine, misperceptions. Each side gets a chance to explain the intentions behind different signals, different goals, right? It's this low-cost, no-cost initiative that the U.S. has used for years to stabilize the nuclear relationship with China, to reduce misunderstandings and miscalculations, and to engage actors in diplomacy in the Chinese system outside of the foreign ministry channels, to make other actors in the Chinese national security system stakeholders in various forms of engagement with the U.S. So there are all these benefits at like no cost, the cost of holding meetings, right? That we use in the China relationship, and I think we can and must do something similar with North Korea. And that requires engaging the KPA, the military, it requires engaging the National Defense Commission. And that is obviously very controversial. I've said the word controversy like 20 times today. But what's the downside? And when internally you have different stakeholders in the North Korean systems advocating for different kinds of policies, would it not be desirable for a KPA general or members of the National Defense Commission to think about their upcoming meetings with U.S. nuclear experts? Or if they're aware of our sensitivities to certain kind of moves or how we perceive their moves, wouldn't that benefit everybody? Wouldn't that make the situation inherently more stable and reduce risks of miscalculation? Why would we not want that? And also, there's this huge gap of information that we just don't have about North Korean nuclear doctrine, about how North Korea thinks about its nuclear weapons. People like me, people like Dan Pinkston, we make inferences about North Korean nuclear strategy. We don't know anything, really. And to be honest, neither does the North Korean foreign ministry. No offense. And so we need to engage actors who are involved in nuclear strategy actively, not just their negotiating strategy, but their nuclear strategy. And that's their defense establishment. We need engagement with them too. And then, I do think we need to declare an end to the Korean War. It's a small thing and a big thing at the same time. It's small in the sense that it costs nothing. It's big in the sense that it needs to come in parallel with the sort of like longer, bigger rationale for U.S. troop presence in Korea, right? But that's reasonable to do. And frankly, the Korean War ended a long time ago. And so there are reasons to keep troops in Korea. There are reasons to debate it. Let's debate that and not just concretely link the future of U.S. troops to a war that went into armistice 50, 60 years ago. And then one thing, again, how costly is this to the U.S.? I think it's actually something that's in the U.S. interest. The White House, the president, should establish an executive order that prevents, that prohibits the United States from deploying nuclear-capable weapon systems to Korea unless authorized by the president. So some mid-ranking military guy, some mid-ranking official in the U.S. doesn't get to decide that we deploy nuclear bombers to South Korea, that could trigger a war, right? That is a presidential level decision. So it doesn't say that we never do it, but executive orders have the force of law in the United States. And issuing a no nuclear deployment order would mean that only the president could decide that we should be sending nuclear bombers. So again, it's a way of reducing risk of nuclear war. That's in America's interest. These are things that America should be doing in its own interest, but that would also happen to dramatically improve the environment within which nuclear negotiations occur. Only after we've done all this stuff can we jump to the things that nuclear negotiators really want to talk about. We need to prove to North Korea, the burden of proof is on us, that our intentions are different, that we're not going to pull a Gaddafi on him, strip him of his weapons, and then gut him in the street, right? That's on us to prove. So only after this stuff happens can we get to the normal stuff that you're going to hear everybody else talk about when it comes to nuclear negotiations. Oh, let's freeze and gradually roll back their program. Let's close Yongbyon nuclear complex. Yeah, let's do it. But it's not going to happen. Even that small thing is not going to happen unless we can change the context first.
By the way, what is meant by Kim's bathroom?
Let me go back one. So phase one, action one. We do need to freeze North Korea's nuclear activity without Kim's bathroom. So in the Iran nuclear negotiations during the Obama administration, the John Kerry, lead negotiator, Secretary of State, he ran into a problem in negotiating with Iran because they're an enemy, right, of the United States. They called the problem the Ayatollah's bathroom because as an enemy of the United States, there was an inherent right to state secrets, to military secrets. You cannot allow your enemy to see you in the bathroom. So nuclear inspectors must be on the ground, right? Nuclear inspectors must be able to monitor progress, verification, of course. The problem is that they cannot be anywhere and everywhere because then it eliminates all military advantages that the enemy has. This is a very practical matter. Unless you are saying that they must unilaterally disarm if you don't allow them any secrecy. So there has to be, you have to accept the principle of the Ayatollah's bathroom, in North Korea's case, Kim Jong-un's bathroom. In principle, he is allowed to have some state secrets, and that must be accepted as part of the beginning of negotiations. The debate is, where do you draw the line? What is acceptable to be hidden? What is not? But in the 90s, when the US negotiated with North Korea, negotiate like Bob Gallucci and these guys, they did not have the principle of Kim Il-sung's bathroom. It was, they wanted total transparency. The arms control guys in the State Department wanted total transparency. That's not going to work, particularly with a already nuclear North Korea. So we have to accept the principle of Kim's bathroom as a constraint in our negotiations. And I think that would actually make North Korea feel considerably more secure in the negotiations, which means they're not going to look for reasons to delay or to fight it or to not implement what they say. So we want to give North Korea as many reasons as possible to fulfill its commitments. And we've never done that before.
how many tactical nukes do you have to use over the Korean Peninsula?
So we have no tactical nuclear weapons in Korea. I would like to keep it that way. Tactical nuclear weapons are usable nuclear weapons, and nobody wants to use nuclear weapons. So what I want to happen, what I hope happens, is that U.S. negotiators can convince North Korea preemptively to not develop tactical nuclear weapons themselves. And if that means we have to give additional promises that we do not deploy tactical nuclear weapons to Korea, no problem, right? We're already going to do more than that. So we can have a mutual agreement to have no tactical weapons on the peninsula. And that costs North Korea nothing, you know? But that would be huge for reducing risks again. So everything here is animated by this goal of reducing risks of nuclear war. What could be more important? We don't want North Korea to have tactical nukes because tactical nukes are usable nukes. We don't want to have to introduce tactical nukes ourselves to Korea either because that increases risks of use. And then eventually we should get to a point where we have a verifiable freeze of North Korea's nuclear program. When we do that, we can try for, and we have a track record of both sides implementing agreements so that you have a modest base of trust that's established. We have credibly signaled a change of intentions because of this unilateral stuff. Then we can enter agreements for things like a nuclear-free seas initiative. So within 200 nautical miles of the borders of the Korean Peninsula, we both agree neither side will put nuclear weapons into the seas, into the ocean, right? And the reason why it comes so late is because there needs to be some sort of verification regime for that, patrols of some kind, monitoring. And so that would require compromises from North Korea that I think they would not be willing to make initially. And if we're going to reach agreements with North Korea, they need to be credible, implementable. And then, after all of this happens, then we get to the part where everybody wants to start. So this is completely changing the goalposts of U.S. policy. Then we figure out how we can reduce medium-range and short-range ballistic and cruise missiles by North Korea. This is up for debate. I don't have a huge problem with North Korean intercontinental ballistic missiles because the capability is less well developed. And if North Korea launches a long-range missile at U.S. territory, it really is game over. Like, that's super war. That's tragedy. But North Korea has lots of shorter range missiles that do not directly threaten the United States that it could easily and probably gladly launch at Japan or reluctantly launch at South Korea in a contingency, right? And so it's the medium and short range stuff that threatens allies directly. ICBMs are not intended to threaten the allies. It's intended to threaten the US directly. So I think it's a huge signal of US commitment and US leadership to accept that risk of the ICBM and say, you know what? We're at risk, but we're in it to win it. And we're gonna use negotiations to reduce the threat of missiles to allies. That's proof of our commitment to allies. And so the nuclear rollback, capping and reducing the number of weapons and the types of weapons that North Korea has, that can happen short of denuclearization, but it requires all this other stuff to happen first. Otherwise, why would North Korea do it? You have to give them as much incentive as possible to entertain reducing its nuclear deterrent. And then the final, most ambitious thing is the thing that some of my friends want us to do first, which is to get a declaration of North Korea's nuclear inventory. If your goal is denuclearization, you really do need an early declaration of inventory, because otherwise North Korea is lying to you. If they can't provide this declaration of nuclear inventory, there's no way they're going to denuclearize. And that's true. That's why I say, A, they're not going to denuclearize. B, so what? So let's wait on this. There is no urgency to getting full transparency into North Korea's nuclear arsenal if we're accepting that they're going to have nuclear weapons. This step, you want to achieve it eventually because it helps stability. But North Korea is only going to do this when it has sufficient confidence that we're not just going to light them up and target all the stuff that they've told us about. And so this is a complete, this looks very boring. This is a complete 180 degree reversal of like everything America has tried with North Korea for the past 30 years. And that's what the controversy is. So I would freely admit, even if the US fully, faithfully implemented what I'm recommending here and all these proposals on the timeline that I've proposed, I fully admit there's like a 60% chance of success. Success being agreements that we reach with North Korea, that North Korea implements and that the US implements. But that's how dismal the situation is. That's how much of a loser this situation has become for the United States. The United States has lost on North Korea policy. We have to acknowledge it. And if you can't acknowledge when you've lost, you cannot learn. And if we know anything from international relations, it's that if you cannot learn, you cannot escape anarchy. You cannot escape the kind of world where everybody needs nukes, that justifies nukes. So we have to start by acknowledging the reality that we have lost on this goal that becomes more and more unrealistic over time. And only then can we show that we have learned, and only by learning can we proceed to actually make the world a bit safer. So why could this work where everything else has failed? Why could I be so audacious and not even wear a tie today? One reason is because it asks this whole blueprint proposal for arms control. It asks North Korea to give up much less than we've ever asked them to give up. Again, denuclearization equals unilateral disarmament. We're saying North Korea, we acknowledge they're going to need a strategic deterrent. We acknowledge that we hate their nuclear weapons, but there are reasons why they have them. The issue is accountability and control and stability, particularly managing the risks of inadvertent nuclear use, which is plausible. The second reason why this blueprint could work is because even to the extent that we ask anything of North Korea, we significantly delay when we expect them to deliver on these things. We're not creating this tit-for-tat structure of negotiations like in the early 90s, where you do something, we do something, you do something, we do something. It has to be, the only way it succeeds is if everybody does everything perfectly. You have to have a discount for failure, for bureaucratic shortfalls, for hedging and mistrust. I mean, frankly, North Korea lied to us in the 90s. They violated the spirit of the agreed framework, but not the letter of the law of the agreed framework. And it's understandable that they did so. It was a hedge, because they cannot trust the United States. So we can't structure a negotiation or a bargain with North Korea that involves such perfectly synchronized moves, because no diplomatic effort is ever perfectly executed, especially not with the United States, especially these days. So there needs to be time built in to say, you know what, there are things we need to do that may make you more secure, but we need to do it for us, all those unilateral actions. And that should prove to you that we're serious about looking at you and this situation differently. And then only then can we talk transactions. And because of that, this is the only time that I know of that people talking about, or somebody talking about and proposing a roadmap for nuclear negotiations is primarily focused on how to make it credible, how to build trust, how to make it something that's more than a transaction. I hide the theory here. I don't put theory in the presentation or in the report, but what we know in political science, particularly for how like great power rivals dealing with smaller adversaries can build trust, we know it's very, very hard to do. It's almost impossible, but it can happen. And the key is to changing the narratives around transactionalism. And that's precisely what I've structured here. I've structured a real-world version of how enemies become friends. still it's only a 60% chance of success. But that's better than the current 0% chance of success. And North Korea does get things from what they get a lot of what they want from the proposed initiatives here. So how can Steve Biegun or his successor actually convince North Korea to verifiably freeze, cap, roll back its nuclear weapons when it's never happened before? How specifically will the diplomats who sit down convince North Korea of those kinds of changes? I have prescribed a basket of inducements or concessions that the United States could offer at the bargaining table. The timing, some of the content, it depends on the very fluid nature of negotiations. So I don't want to be overly prescriptive. But there are things the United States can do that are of acceptable risk levels for the United States, but that are valuable to North Korea, that North Korea wants. We all know right now, I mean, the main impediment on nuclear diplomacy right now is sanctions relief. North Korea has been reasonably clear about that. I think in a different era, sanctions relief is too hard, not worth the effort, particularly because there's a good chance North Korea fails to fulfill its end of any bargain it makes with us. However, the alternative is that North Korea keeps developing nuclear weapons and the trajectory makes the US and its allies less stable relative to North Korea. The North Korea situation is less stable if we don't do something to change it. And if the United, if North Korea, in a worst case scenario, gets sanctions relief, gets some degree of economic development, luxury goods are allowed to come back in the country or something, and then it takes all that and pockets it and then gives up no nukes, like, that could happen, right? We've had versions of that happen before. But does that threaten the Republic? Does that threaten the United States' existence? No. That is the kind of risk, the biggest risk that the United States would have in that scenario is the risk of diplomatic embarrassment. Like, oh man, North Korea took us to the cleaners again. They're such good negotiators. Okay. That's the worst case scenario if we grant sanctions relief, is that we look stupid. Okay, I'll be North Korea envoy. I'm willing to look stupid to make that happen, right? Because there's a chance that you take that move and it helps change things in a different context. Cooperative Threat Reduction Funds, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but this is congressional funding after the Cold War that was used to basically pay off former Soviet Union nuclear scientists and create programs for nuclear security to stabilize the post-Soviet environment and to control the spread of nuclear weapons. So it was about nuclear safety. And CTR funds, Cooperative Threat Reduction Funds, this is still a program that the U.S. runs. And since the end of the Cold War, it has spread from the Soviet Union to countries all over the world. It is a general purpose fund that's targeted at nuclear security all around the world. Up to this point, there has never been any discussion that I know of about using these funds to enhance nuclear security in North Korea. Yet where could it be more useful than in North Korea? Where could it be more valuable to ensure nuclear safety and security than in North Korea? So this is, again, it's like something that's in the US interest because it's stability, it's reducing that risk of war and the risk of proliferation, but it's the kind of thing that would benefit North Korea too. North Korea doesn't want its nukes to escape, and North Korea would end up indirectly getting some foreign currency and funding. There's a financial element to this too that North Korea would benefit from. And one of the co-sponsors of the legislation that initially created this, so Senators Nunn Lugar in the United States, in the middle of the nuclear crisis with North Korea, they proposed that this funding should be available for North Korea situations. So it's not like I'm making this up myself. Like, the originators of the legislation think that this is something that could make sense in the future. And then everybody knows the value of a peace regime process, right? Controversial, but also necessary in some sense. It's not something the United States could do alone either. It's a multi-party thing. The biggest controversy here is what I've labeled phased troop reduction in South Korea. And again, this is part of a bargaining inducement with North Korea. So like how you would structure this very much depends on the circumstances and the negotiations, where we are with North Korea, the strategic relationship. But I've sketched out a proposal. It's not in this report. It's something separate that argues that you could, in the name of deterrence, in the name of actually enhancing deterrence, not just diplomacy, you could reduce the presence of U.S. troops in Korea to about 14,000 and have a stronger deterrent than you do right now, because it's about modernizing the deterrence posture. It's about structuring forces in South Korea to pose a minimum offensive threat to North Korea, but to make maximum ability to react rapidly, decisively to any kind of like North Korean physical attack. And so you structure forces in such a way that their purpose is not the classical tripwire of US forces here exist so that you can bring 300,000 troops into the peninsula. And that's not their purpose. Their purpose is to respond quickly to events that happen in the, you know, the West Sea or the Yellow Sea, and it happens somewhere along the DMZ. And so it's amphibious forces, it's Marines, it's cruise missiles, it's advanced technology, fifth generation fighters, but that's a modest presence in terms of size. So if you change, if you restructure the composition of the troop presence here, you could achieve an even greater deterrent capability, but you could do so in a way that reduces the risk of offensive threat to North Korea. And to be able to do that with fewer troops is like win, win, win. And so that would be, again, something that I think is in the alliance interest and in the US interest and done for reasons of deterrence, but it has value within the negotiation context. So if I say there's a 60% chance of success, 40% chance of failure if we do this, there is this question of how you manage the risks. So this should be part, any strategy is gonna have risks. The issue is like, how transparent are you about the risks that your strategy generates, and how do you manage those risks? So there is a risk with North Korea that if negotiations fail, if an arms control regime fails with North Korea, all that's left for stability is deterrence. So we need to, separate from the negotiation process, we need to adjust our force posture in Korea in a way that does reduce troops, but does so, like I said, in a manner that strengthens deterrence. The types of capabilities that you have is what matters, not the number of troops, when it comes to deterrence. And so as a way to ensure deterrence against a North Korea that it has nuclear weapons and where we have no arms control regime in place, no restraining mechanisms in place, one of the things we need to do is update or modernize our deterrence posture. And again, that involves like a longer proposal, but the number is like somewhere between 14 and 17,000 troops. So whose boots are here? It's very different than what's set up now. More modern, more high tech, more frankly like Marines and special forces and fewer army. The second thing is like we have with the US and South Korea alliance, even now we have these extended deterrence consultation mechanisms, right? And it's a way of trying to reassure South Korea of the US commitment generally, and of the commitment of the nuclear umbrella to South Korea's defense in particular. Obviously, this is something that is not emphasized in the current era because it's at odds with trying to build goodwill with North Korea. But if the United States does this proposal that I'm making, depending on who's running South Korea, like liberal or conservative administration, there could be huge alliance concerns, angst, fear of abandonment, based on what is being proposed here. And again, it depends on who's in charge here. But even in a liberal administration, like if this happened right now, I think the Moon administration might have some concerns about some of the things I'm proposing, right? And so the United States has to invest in mechanisms, institution building that systematically ensures that when we make decisions about North Korea, we're consulting with allies. One of the problems in the nuclear crisis in 2017 was that the United States was making all of this bombastic, you know, threat making, all the rhetoric, the fire and fury stuff. That was not done in consultation with South Korea. South Korea was not on board with the bloody nose idea, right? And so we have a reassurance problem with South Korea that my arms control report raises. Any arms control initiative with North Korea creates a reassurance problem with South Korea and Japan. And so we need to start building mechanisms to ensure that we don't heighten feelings of ally abandonment too much. This is common sense, you know, the ABCs of how do you take care of your alliance, right? Just be considerate of your ally. And so these are ways of managing the risks of this larger proposal to initiate an arms control process. And then this is just the mic drop punchline. It's the paradox of the whole situation. If you have an arms control regime, you will be substantially closer to denuclearization than you are right now. But to get an arms control regime, you have to actually give up on denuclearization. So you gotta give up on denuclearization to move closer to denuclearization. And that sucks, but it's true, and it's real. And I'm the only one being honest.